This is the second talk of the morning sessions, and I promise the morning sessions will be more devoted to the practice of meditation, answering those questions which you would have asked anyway. I've only just scratched the surface of meditation so far. When I was talking about just present moment awareness, obviously there's much more to meditation than that. Last night, if you paid attention and question time, I said that the most important part of meditation is the attitude which you have to your meditation object, whatever that object is. And this is a crucial teaching in meditation. If this is all you understand about meditation, you do really, really well. And that is that whatever you are experiencing throughout your meditation, the most important thing is your attitude towards that experience. If you don't like it and try and get rid of it to get something else, then you are missing the point. If you want something more because you're not satisfied with the state of meditation you have, you'll get nowhere. The way of meditation is learning whatever you're experiencing right now to let it be. Make peace with it. To be kind, to open the door of your heart to it. And be very gentle and patient. I never actually mentioned that patience is of two kinds. This is just one insight which I had some years ago. I call those two types of patience waiting in the future and waiting in the present. The first type of patience is not real patience at all. Waiting in the future is waiting for something to happen, waiting for the peace to come, waiting for the lights, waiting for enlightenment. It's always waiting in the future, expecting, hoping something might happen. And whenever you wait for something in the future, you're abandoning this present moment called now. You're not here. You're looking further along the road on which you hope to travel. And you're not looking at where you're stepping right now. So that is what we call waiting in the future. And many of you on this retreat will fall into that mistake, waiting for something to happen, expecting for something to happen, when you're losing the place where you should really be looking right now. So waiting in the future, waiting for something to happen, is wrong patience. And right patience is waiting in this moment, waiting with what you have, or to use a little trick of language, to waiting on the moment, in the same way that in a restaurant you have a waiter who waits on you. A waiter, if they're going to get a tip, will always be aware of their customer to see when they finish their first course. If they take the plate away too soon and they're not really finished, or they deliver the next course too late, they're not going to get a good tip. So a waiter at a restaurant is someone who is always mindful and aware of their customer's table. They always know just the right time to bring the next course, or the right time to take the previous course away. That's what we mean by waiting in this moment, or rather waiting on the moment. It's not expecting something to happen, it's not waiting in the future for things to occur. It's literally waiting on whatever you're experiencing right now. This present moment is your customer. Care for it. So by making peace, or letting be, being kind, being gentle, and being patient, you are practicing, as I mentioned last night, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which is an important factor. It's right intention, it's right thought. If mind is a forerunner of all things, then this thought, this intention, is that forerunner. If you get right intention correct, if you really are making peace, being kind, being gentle, then you know that you're on the path. You know that good results have to occur. It doesn't occur straight away. You have to build up peace. So if you want to feel peaceful in this meditation, if you want to know what peace of mind feels like, you have to make peace. And you never find peace by making war. You never find peace by fighting a battle. and some of you do fight battles with your mind in meditation. Instead, you make peace with it. You allow it to be. You accept it. You are like, your mind may be like that demon in the Emperor's palace. You say, welcome, mind. Thank you for coming. Crazy mind, I love you as you are. I'm not trying to get rid of you. And just as in that wonderful Buddhist psychology of the demon in the Emperor's palace, the monster in the Emperor's palace, through that kindness and acceptance, the quality gets smaller and smaller to be totally anxious. That's exactly what happens in the meditation. When you make peace, you make peace, you have peace. When you have kindness, when you make kindness with every moment, soon that your mind wants to stay with you. If you are angry in your mind, if you keep telling the mind what to do, if you order the mind, will your mind stay with you? Of course it won't. Imagine, this is a simile which I've been telling a lot recently. Imagine that you invite your best friend out for coffee. So you call them up and you say, come out for a cup of coffee. We're not going to go to Glory and Jeans or Dome. We're going to go to Starbucks. And you're not going to have a latte or a flat white. You're going to have a long black. And you're not going to have any sugar in your coffee. And instead of having a muffin, you're going to have a biscuit. And we're going to sit at a table in the corner where I like, on this table in the window where you like. And we're going to talk about double, we're not going to talk about your family. And we're going to sit there for 1 hour, not too long, not too short. And you're going to let me do most of the talking. And if you invite your friend like that, would your friend accept? Or would they say, I've got something on this afternoon. I'm sorry, I can't make it. Because that's not the way to treat a friend, is it? If you bring up a friend and invite him out for a cup of coffee, what's the sort of conversation you have? You say, I've heard there's a new coffee shop opened up just down the road. I've heard of a better one which has just opened up. Okay, we'll go to your coffee shop. And when you go there, you say, what do you want? You never tell your friend what they're going to drink. Nor are you going to tell your friend what table they're going to sit at and what they're going to eat and how long they're going to be there and what they're going to talk about. Because if you do, your friend will run away. Now do you understand why your mind is restless? Why your mind runs away from you? Because you treated it badly. Before you said, right mind, sit down, we're going to meditate. And you're going to watch the breath. At the tip of the nose, not the belly. You're going to watch it go in and go out. And you're going to do it this way, not that way. When Ajahn Brahms repeats, you're going to do Ajahn Brahms way, not the previous Brahms way. And you're going to sit here for 1 hour. You're not going to chatter. No thoughts, no expectations. And you tell all this to your poor mind. No wonder, at the first chance it has, it runs away from you. Why? Because you treated it like a slave. With no respect. So instead, understanding the nature of the mind, you treat your mind with respect, as a friend, as an equal. I think I said this to a few people, I think maybe in the question time. At the previous retreat which I gave over in Perth, I told one gentleman, I said, when you get up in the morning, I want you to ask your mind, what do you want to do today? And treat your mind like a friend. And throughout the whole day, whatever you're doing, every now and again, say, mind, what do you want to do now? And see what happens. And sometimes you'd ask that, and his mind said, no, I want to think about the family. Okay, we'll think about the family now. And other times the mind would say, no, I want to meditate now. And he had some very wonderful meditations, and he was so happy all day. He was not fighting his mind. He was being kind to his mind. That's how you train the mind, in peace, in kindness, and in gentleness. So what I said last night was the most important part of meditation. Please remember that. I think I did see somebody here who's got one of my meditation centers, a Jhana Grove t-shirt. He's got Jhana Grove on the front and on the back. He's got, make peace, be kind, be gentle, Ajahn Brahm. And And that's very, very important to remember those things. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. In every moment. And then you'll find everything gets so peaceful and kind and wonderful and joyful. You have a wonderful time. Now, what usually happens to many people at the beginning of meditation, and already people in the interview times have asked me the same questions. I said yesterday that sometimes when I ask any questions, nobody actually asks a question. But when I finish, they line up and ask the questions. Or during the interviews, they ask the same question, one after the other, after the other. And of course, the question which they asked yesterday, what do I do with dullness? I get sleepy in meditation. What do I do with restlessness? And of course, those are the biggest hindrances in meditation. So I'm now going to talk about those. Now, straight away with dullness, the worst thing you can possibly do is fight with it and try to conquer your dullness. I remember as a monk when I was in Thailand the first couple of years, we used to get up not at 5 o'clock. We're really soft, you namby-pamby pink-huffs. We used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Although it was actually optional in Thailand. You could always get up earlier, but no later. That was the only option. We used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, go to bed after 10 o'clock. So we only had about my average was about 4.5 hours at night. At the time I thought that this is what you're supposed to do to train yourself. Now I'm much wiser, I know that that is simply not enough for many people. So I was got up in the morning at 3 o'clock or earlier, and we started our first meditation at 3:15 in the hall. And I was always dull and sleepy. Isn't that nice? Actually, that's a good point. Thank you for doing that, Hector, but please, check your mobile phones, your pages, and anything else which makes a noise, and make sure it's turned off. Because the world is not going to end if you don't answer your emails. You are not Obama, so you don't really need to answer your emails. They're not important. Your family is still going to be there when you leave. So anyway, I was sleep deficit. Okay, getting up at 3:15 in the morning. Had to meditate for a couple of hours. And it was hot. There was no air con in those jungles. And I was an English monk. I'm a monk. You know, you're not used to such heavy temperatures. And also, what else was there? Oh yeah, the food we used to eat there was disgusting food. Even for a Westerner, not even for a Thai, even for people in Bangkok, they couldn't stand the food in the northeast. And you know all the food we used to eat? Snails, frogs, crickets, ants' eggs, anything which lived, we ate. And it was disgusting food. That was the first thing I was told when I went to Thailand in the northeast. Don't ask what's in the curry. Because once you find out, you don't want to eat it anymore. You know, the grossest thing which I ate, that was actually one of the grossest things I ate, was the pork and rice. We had one meal a day, no breakfast, just one meal. And for that meal that day, it was a very poor part of Thailand. We had a bowl of sticky rice, glutinous rice. And the only thing we had to eat with it was a frog. A boiled frog. Not seasoned, no garlic or salt or anything, just as if the frog had jumped into boiling water and something took it out. And there was spray on top of your rice. It looked disgusting, but my goodness, it tasted disgusting. And I used to be a vegetarian before. At that particular time, I'd been given anything for some vegetables or some fruit, but we had no vegetables, no fruit. That's all it was, just one frog and a bowl of rice. And of course, you start eating the legs, just like in France. There's something you can eat there, that's not so bad, but that's not enough to keep you going for the day. So they just started picking out its insides, its organs, and eating them. Which was disgusting, but at least there was some protein. I was very fortunate. I paid attention at school in biology class. I knew which organ was which. The man sitting next to me did not. Taking out the organs, he pressed what he never understood was a frog's bladder, which still had urine in it, and a frog pee all over his mouth. That was absolutely disgusting. He couldn't eat after that. You know, when his illness is a dead frog, it still has urine in it. When he pressed the thing, just came out, you know, the bottom there went all over his rice, the yellow stuff. So he told me after that. So that was how disgusting it was. So that's not exaggeration, that's absolutely accurate, 100% accurate. And so I was also malnourished. So there you were, sleep deprived, not used to the climate, malnourished. So what did I do when I started meditating in the morning? Fell asleep. Most mornings your head would droop as you went into darkness. And I thought that that was bad. And so I started fighting and fighting and fighting, struggling with my will to break through that darkness. And what happened? A lot of times I just got frustration, got a headache. But sometimes I break through. I break through the darkness into restlessness, and I couldn't stop thinking. And so what did I do then? I calmed my thoughts down. And when they calmed down, I fell asleep again. It was like a pendulum going between restlessness and dullness. And I just could not find that place in the middle where I was awake but still. And it took me years to work out how foolish I had been. Because if you are dull, it means you haven't got much energy. And you're wasting that energy fighting, fighting, fighting. Which means you usually get more dull. If you do manage to get enough energy to conquer dullness, that energy is so strong, like a wild force, you cannot control it, and you're just thinking about all sorts of things, you're restless. That was not the way to overcome the dullness. And because part of Buddhism is reflection inside, instead of just fighting the dullness, we want to understand it. Where does dullness come from? What actually is it? What's the problem? What's the cause? When you realize that dullness is a natural phenomenon of the brain because you're sleep deprived, you may be sick, maybe too hot, not had enough food that day, you're tired, then understanding its causes is mostly the lack of energy. And I decided that whenever I'm down, I'm going to make peace with my dullness. I'm not going to fight it. I'm going to be kind to it. I'm going to be gentle with it. I'm going to regard it as a sickness which I'm not going to conquer, which I'm going to just gently relax into and allow it to heal by itself. And so I just let it be. With his great words, let it be. And I just was with my dullness. Yeah, you can't be so mindful, but I know I was dull, but I was accepting it. I wasn't thinking this is a great failing of me as a meditator. I just let it be. And as I let it be, because I was not wasting any of my mental energy in negativity and fighting, I observed the dullness get less and less, like a mist lifting in the early morning of a cold country. I was just with that dullness. It only takes about 5 minutes and the dullness totally lifted. But now, because I wasn't fighting, because I wasn't hating my dullness, because I was just letting it be with kindness, when it did lift, I was left not with restlessness anymore, but a beautiful state of peace. I was aware and still. And I realized that that is the best way of overcoming the dullness. And in fact, I love telling a story from the commentaries. Because in the Buddhist commentaries, they did notice there's only a very few times did the Buddha smile. And when the Buddha did smile, it was for an important reason. And one of those times was relating to this story. The Buddha was with his attendant, Ananda, as they were walking through the forest. And as they walked in a certain part of the forest, they saw a monk sitting meditation. He had a perfect posture, right foot over left foot in full lotus, right hand over left hand with the thumbs touching, the back perfectly straight, the chin technique, eyes closed but not too tight, meditating on the breath. A perfect posture. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about that monk." Sure enough, 2 weeks later, he got his Peter's robe and got married. And then a little while later, in another part of the forest, the Buddha saw another monk meditating. But this monk's posture was not so hot, and he was nodding this way and nodding that way, nodding this way and nodding that way. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled, and said, "I'm not worried about that monk." And 2 weeks later, he was fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. So those are all of those stories and think, hey, they've got it wrong. They must have translated it the wrong way round. That can't be true. Surely that monk who is sitting up straight, putting effort into his posture and meditation, surely he would be the one to get enlightened. And that slacker, not putting any energy at all in his meditation, nodding this way and nodding that way, no, he's going to destroy him. He's not really the tough guy. He's going to sort of just lose it. But the opposite was the case. And that story stayed with me for a long time. So what happened? There was one of my fellow monks, he ordained only a short while after me. He was a French monk. And whenever he would be meditating, you know, in good meditation, even at 3:15 in the morning, even when we meditated all night without any sleep, he was always perfectly straight. I never saw him nod once. No one saw him nod. He seemed to have no slot to talk at all. And he was a very quiet monk. He hardly spoke to anybody. And no, the word was that that monk was, if he wasn't enlightened already, he was so close. And after 4 years, I found out he disrobed. I couldn't believe it. He disrobed. He was one of the star meditators. He would never know. And then, after he disrobed, he told us what had been happening all those years. He said that he was struggling so hard with his body, putting forth immense effort every time he meditated, not allowing himself to be sleepy. He said that was so painful. He said sometimes he would open his eyes, see monks like me nodding, and he'd be so curious, if only I could do that. And he said after 3 or 4 years he could stand it no longer. He had to disrobe. He is what we call the control freak, who controls their body, who tries to control their mind, and you just get so stressed out. For him it was an amazing achievement, he could last for so long. But it's a feeling talk to people, we could advise them otherwise. But because he was a bit shy, he never talked to people. He made that mistake for such a long time. He had such a painful experience as a monk. And of course, he never got the benefits of meditation. And I like telling that story for each one of you. Please don't be a control freak. You can sit perfectly still for physically for 1 or 2 hours. So can those soldiers outside the Buckingham Palace, but they never get enlightened. They go down to the pub afterwards. That is not meditation, that is controlling. Meditation is totally the opposite. Letting go of craving, not more craving. Letting go of wanting, not more wanting. So when you are tired, let yourself be tired. Do not fight. If you do that, you will find that after a while, the cause of tiredness disappears. You come here to this retreat from your jobs, from your families, some from a long, long distance away, and you will come into this retreat for tiredness. It will take a time for it to disappear. And the best way to make it disappear is not wasting energy fighting battles with yourself. Instead, be kind to yourself. You always remember the Buddha as such a compassionate and kind being. And the compassionate and kind being would love you for who you are, asleep, restless, perhaps she accepts you, as you should accept your own mind. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And you'll find that way, after a while, the sloth and torpor disappears. And it's replaced by peace, not by this terrible restlessness. The other problem which people have is this, they say they can't stop thinking. They can't stop thinking about their family, fantasizing, dreaming, planning, working out solutions to all the problems of your lives. And you've got lots of problems, each one of you. Some of you have got lots of problems, but I don't worry about them. I leave them in hurt. They're not allowed in checking baggage on the aircraft. So I leave them alone. And they, it's amazing, because how many problems sort themselves out? You just leave them alone, you don't do anything, and somebody else sorts it out for you. So I love that, Jesus being irresponsible. Irresponsible in the sense of wise irresponsibility, not worrying about it over much, but your problem usually sorts itself out. So much of the problems I've tried to solve in life, and I've gone in there and tried to solve them, I've usually made them worse. If I could just stand back and leave them alone, they're usually hit by themselves. In the same way, if you've got a wound on your hand, you just clean it up so there's no sort of bacteria there, put on a band-aid, and leave it alone. And surprise, surprise, it heals itself up. Imagine you've got a cut on your hand, you put the band-aid on, and after 5 minutes you look at it, you'll get no something. Another 5 minutes, maybe I should put some weapon on, see, put some weapon on, and you put it, the band-aid back again. Another 5 minutes, that's the wrong type of weapon. Somebody said the other one is good, so you open it up, take the old weapon off, and put some new weapon on top. Why can't you leave it alone? Because if you keep bothering it, then it will never heal. So that's why letting things go is a great way of solving problems. And a very effective and efficient way of solving problems. So just put a band-aid on, leave it alone, and it heals really well all by itself. So all the worries we have is just totally illogical, irrational, and it makes things worse. But we can't stop doing this. Now why can't we stop thinking? Number one is because we're not used to silence. In fact, we're afraid of silence. So it's important in meditation to keep the silence outside. Already many, many people are well deserving of the masking tape. Could you be talking too much? It's all right for the helpers to talk because they have to arrange the breakfast and the lunch. But, they're the staff, they're the workers, you're the meditators. So you don't have to speak. You can be silent. You don't have to say anything to anybody. So shut up. And why is it you can't stop speaking? Actually, it's just the mind is restless, so you want to sort of engage with people. That's the real problem. And a lot of it is because we don't feel comfortable not talking. In the same way, we don't feel comfortable being silent. And some people in our modern days, they don't even know what silence means. So what do you mean being silent? You say you can't be silent. Remember this one guy came up to me and said, look, it's impossible to be silent inside. You have to be. And I said, no, you don't. Yes, I have. No, you don't. And I'm going to prove it to you. And this is a wonderful example. If any of you ever go to teach meditation, please use this little example. Because it's so effective. And I've used this to show people how easy it is to be silent. And how people who have never noticed a moment of silence in their head now know what silence is. Because in this little example, I want you to contribute by not just listening to what I'm saying, but also being mindful of your reaction inside your head as I'm speaking. Be mindful of the reaction inside as I'm speaking, because as I'm speaking, you will begin to notice some crosses between my words. In those spaces between my words, what was going on in your mind? There it was again. You were silent. You knew without giving anything to me. You were aware without thinking how easy that is. It's a great exercise, isn't it? Because you could do it and you were silent. Now you know what silence is like. You have failed to recognize silence. But once you recognize silence, you find you get to the next level, which is becoming familiar with silence. Which means that when silence is there, you say, oh, this is silence again. And then you get to the next stage, you're at ease with the silence. You don't need to disturb it. You relax into the silence. When you're with something you don't know, you've never been there before, you always get tense. But when you recognize your surroundings and you're familiar with them, you can just become an easer. So you don't need to disturb the silence. It's just silence. Now, after a while of meditating, you can become so at ease with the silence inside the mind, it just you can leave alone and it stays for a long, 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 long time. You know how wonderful that is just to be aware in this moment without a thought going on in your mind? Perfectly silent and still. That is like this experience I had last year in Penang. Because after I leave here, I go to Penang to teach a retreat. And this was 25th of December last year. I just finished giving the talk at the retreat in Mahindrarama in Penang. And then you had the questions and the signing of the books and the photographs. I got back to my room about 10:30. And I was tired. I just wanted to rest. Even monks get tired. We want to have a sleep. Unfortunately, because it was Christmas, on the opposite of the road outside my room, they were having a party, a Christmas party, a karaoke party. And they're the worst type of parties in the whole world. I'm sure that people who misbehave in this life and break all their precepts go to that particular hell known as the hell of the karaoke singers, where you have to endure out of tune, loud singing for a long, long time. And that's what I had to endure. Because you know what it's always like? There's always some lady who's over 60 who thinks she can sing. And she's already had too much alcohol, so she sings really, really loudly. And they were going off to 1:30 till 1 o'clock in the morning. Keeping me awake, there's no way anyone could go away. It wouldn't be so bad if they could sing in tune. You know, it's terrible, this karaoke party. But when it finished, oh, that's such a relief. There was silence. They went to bed and now I could get some sleep. Oh, that was such bliss that this terrible noise had ended. And that's what it's like when this noise, this karaoke party between your ears, finishes. All this thinking, thinking, thinking stops. Peace at last. So a lot of that restlessness is because you don't recognize silence. You don't know it well enough. So you can't relax into the silence and just enjoy it. Because you don't value silence. Because you will find whatever your mind thinks is most important to you, that's what you'll say. If you think solving your problems is really important, then you'll spend all the time just solving problems. If you think that fantasizing is really important, then you go fantasizing. Whatever you give importance to will be in your mind. So please, to stop restlessness, please give importance to silence, to stillness, to peace. You can sit any time of your life, but how often is it can you sit quietly and do some meditation? This is a rare opportunity for you. You've got time off from your husband, from your wife. You've got time off from work. This is your holiday time. Don't waste it. Enjoy every moment. Already one or two days have gone past. The days are going. There's only 7 days left. You better hurry up because it's going, and you'll be back to work with your family and your kids, and it's all gone. Oh no! This is actually important. Any of you ever do public speaking? Don't go speaking in a monotone all the time, the same tone. Please alter the tone of your voice. Be dramatic. And then people will wake up and they'll be listening to you. Because sometimes I've been with public speakers and they just go on and on and on, the same tone of voice. And it's really boring. And maybe talk about some interesting stuff. They never change the modulation of their voice or do anything. There you go. So, back to restlessness. If you value the silence and the peace and the stillness more than anything else, that's really important to you. Then, you won't be thinking about things. You know, in one sutta, the Buddha gave this incredibly powerful simile. It was gross, but it was powerful. And I loved it. He said, it's just like a young man or young woman are going out for the night. And so they dress in their most beautiful clothes and do their hair up, girls wear the makeup. And they really sort of set themselves up to be pretty and beautiful. And then they go and put a garland, a necklace of dead dogs around their neck. Rotting, stinking, decaying dead dogs. And then they look, yeah, what have I put around my neck? And they throw it away as soon as possible. And he said, thoughts are like the carcasses of dead dogs which you put around your beautiful mind. What are you doing that for? Wow, I never thought my thoughts were so disgusting. Even my good thoughts, I know that some of my bad thoughts might be disgusting, but my good thoughts, are they like carcasses of dead dogs as well? The Buddha said, yes. All your thoughts about dead things, old ideas, and your beautiful mind, the great stillness, is being covered by this stuff which we call thinking. So shut up and listen to life rather than having a commentary about it. Now that interview, which I did yesterday evening, I mentioned a brilliant story, which was from the biography of Lao Tzu. He would allow his students to go on a walk with him every evening, but only one student. And there was a rule that if you went on a walk with the great master, you had to keep silent. You weren't allowed to speak. And it happened one evening, a new guy went on a walk with the master, and they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. And it was such an amazingly beautiful sunset, you know, the golds and the crimsons and the purples streaking along the horizon, and just the edges of those clouds, just like being glittering gold in the fading sunlight. It was magnificent. And this young student couldn't help himself by saying, wow, what a beautiful sunset. He'd broken the rule. He'd spoken. And Lao Tzu turned around, went home to the monastery, and said when he got back that that student was never allowed ever again throughout his life to go on a walk with the master because he had broken the rule. And the other students said, that's a bit too extreme, too severe. There's only one sentence anyway. What's wrong with speaking? And then the master said something which I really remember. I got it and understood why we should be silent. He said, "When my student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't watching the sunset. He was only watching the words." There's a huge difference here between thinking about life and experiencing life. Thinking about life, you're experiencing the thoughts. You're not experiencing life. The simile which I give for this is a simile of the professor in Kuala Lumpur. This professor of philosophy was very, very intelligent. And one day he read in the newspapers and in the New Straits Times that a new restaurant was being opened up here in PJ. 5-star restaurant. I mean real 5-star. And so liking his food, he rang up the restaurant to try and book a table. He had to wait 2 months for a reservation. That's how popular the restaurant was. Nevertheless, he wanted to eat there so much, he put his name down and put the date in his diary. And as the days went by, soon it came the day of his reservation in the 5-star restaurant. So that evening, he dressed in one of his best suits and he went to the restaurant. And when he tried to get in, they asked him, "Sir, I need to see your ID to make sure you have a reservation." And he produced his ID. They checked and he said, "Yes, sir, you do have a reservation this evening." So the maitre d' led him to the table. And of course, it was a very, very well apportioned restaurant. The interior decoration was stunning. Everything was just the top quality as you'd expect in a 5-star restaurant. And then the waiter, who was in tails, came to him and gave him the menu. And even the menu was in his thick parchment with gold lettering. And the professor said, "Thank you for the menu." As the waiter left, the professor started eating the menu. And when he finished eating the menu, he paid his bill and left. Because he did not know the difference between the menu and the food. Do you know the difference between the menu and the food? Between the thoughts and your life? So many of you eat the thoughts and you don't eat life. We live in a world of concepts and names and descriptions, and we don't really know what these descriptions are referring to. Peace. Do you know what peace is? You know how to spell it, but how do we experience it? Stillness. Don't eat the words. See what they're pointing to and go there. So every time we get lost in thought, we're actually losing our way. We're losing reality. We're making up this fantasy world of thoughts and ideas. That's why it's so important, if you want to find truth, if you want to experience reality, learn how to listen. Learn how to feel. Learn how to know. Just like that. Without a thought or a name going through your head. That's called a silent awareness. In order to achieve that, there's other tricks, as well as like listening to the space between the words. Try to listen to the space between your own thoughts. See if you can be mindful enough to know when a thought is finished. And know that before the next thought begins, there is a space. There, that's the silence. And if you can notice the space between your own thoughts, just like the space between my words, you know what we're talking about, my inner silence. By noticing it, you'll find that that space grows, gets longer and longer. Why? Because it is a very beautiful experience. Intuitively you know that this is where truth lies. Where insight is found. Not in words, but in silence.
And when you grow in that silence, you find the meditation gets so much easier. It's all this thinking which interrupts the silent mind that stops you experiencing deep meditation. It's all the thinking which gives you these orders which irritates and agitates your own mind. So when you're still, then you can see the Dhamma. So create that stillness. That's one way of doing it, by listening to the space between the thoughts. Another way is like listening to the sounds outside. Because when you're listening to the sounds, you can't be thinking. The nice things about natural sounds, whether it's the sound of the dog barking, or the bird singing, or the sound of the train outside, it comes and in a few seconds, it's gone. It does not linger. So sounds come and go. And it's very hard to actually to do much thinking about the sound of a train. It's very hard to write an essay about train sounds. So sounds are very hard for actually to create thinking about. Which is why listening to the sounds, being mindful of the sounds, stops you living inside the thinking mind in your head. Or be aware of the physical feelings in the body. Especially feelings like the feeling in your bottom pressed against the floor. Can you be aware of your bottom feeling right now? That's a wonderful feeling to know, because either in Malay or Chinese or English, no one's ever got a vocabulary to describe what it feels sitting on the floor with your bottom pressed against the cushion. So it's a feeling which hasn't got a name. Whoopee, which means you can't think about it. But you know it, don't you? So many of the feelings which you experience in your body don't have names, which is why they're great to focus on, because they stop you thinking. So if you ever get lost in thought, break into that train of thought by being aware of the sounds around you. Bring you into the present moment. Be aware of the feelings in the body. That also stops the thinking. Or just see if you can notice the space between those thoughts and the silence. And after a while, your thinking mind will get weaker and weaker and weaker. Until you can just sit down with hardly a thought in your head. Peace at last, totally free from this tyranny of thought. Later on, if you want to understand the meaning of life, yeah, you get the data, the experience first of all, and then you start thinking about it. You don't think about it first. Be silent first. Gather the data. Get the experience. And then you can understand and think about it. Silence first and then thinking. At the very end of the meditation. So that's how we overcome much of restlessness. And also how we overcome much of the dullness of the mind. But there will become times during this meditation retreat when it's as if, as one person once told me in Perth, he said, just now, or just this whole morning, he said, I had to come speak with you because I'm going absolutely crazy with this meditation business. I'm getting an attack of all the hindrances. They're all coming at me at once. I said, that's impossible. How can you have desire and your will at the same time? How can you have restlessness and sloth and torpor? He said, I don't know, but I've got them. It says an attack of all the hips. I'm going crazy, I'm going mad. I can't stop my stupid mind. And so if ever this happens to you, what we call in meditation, an attack of all the hindrances, all at once, a whole gang surrounds you and starts attacking you. What should you do? And so I told him that what I've called the Nalagiri strategy. Now many of you may have gone to Dharma school as kids. If you haven't gone to Dharma school as kids, many Buddhists know the story of Nalagiri. Nalagiri was this elephant who was given alcohol early in the morning to make him crazy. When this elephant was drunk, he was set loose on the narrow streets of Rajagaha. in the direction where the Buddha was coming on arms round. So you can imagine this mad elephant charging and destroying everything in his path. People running all over the place, climbing trees and diving through windows and jumping over walls. And as they were coming close to the Buddha, said to the Buddha, "Get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming, it's destroying everything. Run away, escape, quick." And all the monks, they too jumped over the walls. They climbed up the trees as well. Sometimes monks don't behave as monks, but when a wild elephant is coming, you've got to do something. All except two monks, the Buddha and his faithful attendant, Ananda. Ananda loved his master. Loved him so much, was willing to sacrifice his own life to save the Buddha. So he stepped in front of the Buddha. "Let the elephant take me. I will sacrifice myself for the Buddha." On this retreat, Mandali is handed. Did you hear that from me? Really? I promise? You said yes, but I'm not sure. But then the Buddha smiled, pushed the banner out of the way. "Very, very good. I'm very impressed, but I can have you listen." So Ananda's moments of glory never came to pass. He was pushed out of the way by the Buddha. And so there we were. Like that old movie, High Noon. But this time between the mad elephants and the Buddha, who would win? As this elephant with this enormous power, crazy with alcohol, charging down the street, stomping on things, smashing things with his trunk. This was getting closer and closer to the Buddha. What did the Buddha do? Now remember, the Buddha had great psychic powers. And that's not an exaggeration. Incredibly powerful. If the Buddha had wanted to, he could have grabbed Nandagiri by the trunk, swirled him 3 times around his neck, and thrown the whole elephant 300 kilometers over the Ganges. That'd be easy for someone with the power of the Buddha. But did the Buddha fight violence? Violence?
No.
What did he use?
Metta.
Metta, yes. Nadakim, the door of my heart is open to you. Whatever you do to me, I will always love you. If you stomp me with your great feet and turn me into hamburger patty, I will still love you. I forgive you. If you curl your powerful trunk around my body and smash me against the mango tree, I will always love you and forgive you. Because now again, whatever you do to me, the door of my heart is totally open to you. I love you, not again. Well, something like that. That's not what I actually said. But I think you get the idea. And of course, you all know what happened. You know, in a couple of seconds, Nandagiri was bowing his head placidly in front of the Buddha. And the Buddha was stroking his trunk.
"There, Nandagiri, it's all right, Nandagiri. Never mind, Nandagiri."
As he tamed the mad elephant. Now that's called Nandagiri's attitude. If your mind is going crazy with thoughts, with pain, your meditation is totally psychotic, and you think that you better call the ambulance to take you away. No, not necessary. Your mind is being like Nandagiri, this crazy elephant mind of yours. So say, "Mind, you can smash me up and drive me crazy, but mind, the door of my heart would always be open to you. I forgive you, I love you, my mind." And if you do that, all your restlessness, your craziness, your weird thoughts will all disappear. And in a couple of seconds, your little mind will be bowing in front of you. You say, "There, mine is okay. Never mind. It's all..." If you try to take your mind and swirl it 3 times over your head,
and control it, you'll just make it worse. Another eerie strategy. To deal with the crazy mind that sometimes comes up in meditation. So I think you get the message. I hope. Sometimes I need to reinforce this so many times because you're always trying to control things. Trying to make your mind still, trying to make your mind watch the breath, trying to make your body straight. So controlling, controlling, controlling. No wonder you always get tense in your meditation. For goodness sakes, relax. May peace be kind, be gentle. And then you find all these amazing states of meditation that just come to you. You don't go seeking for them. You're in this moment, you're silent, not doing anything very much, just being aware, mindful, making peace with every moment, being kind, being gentle. And you find because you've made peace for so many moments, you have this great experience of peace. Not the thought of peace, the experience of peace. You have the experience of kindness and gentleness. This beautiful soft, peaceful, still mind. And the way of meditation is that peace, that stillness grows and grows and grows. Just like planting a seed, first you get the sapling. The sapling grows into a young tree, and the young tree into a mature tree. The mature tree to this old tree in the jungle, which is so strong and so tall and beautiful. It all comes from the seed. And the development of the mind is stillness and peace. Once you get the path correct, the way, the method correct, it doesn't matter whether you watch the breath, whether you watch the body feelings. As I said, it doesn't matter what type of meditation you do. What really matters is how you do it. It doesn't matter if you're restless or if you're sleeping. That doesn't matter at all. It's how you're sleeping, how you're restless, what you're doing about it. That really is important. So please try to make peace, be kind, be gentle. And that's something you can always do at any time of today. Even if you're restless, you can always make peace with that, be kind, be gentle, which means there's always something you can do with what you've got. So don't get guilty if you're restless. Don't feel a failure if you're sleeping. Be guilty if you're a failure if you're not making peace with this. If you're not being kind, if you're not being gentle. That is a part of meditation. And that's what leads to letting go. An incredible, beautiful, peaceful, blissful, still space. We understand that. So that's talk number two. And it's all to come yet. It's still only scratching the surface. It's an interesting surface. So now, there was a question I was going to talk about for somebody else's last night. Questions? One, how to handle the Dharma reflections in a sitting meditation. When you're doing sitting meditation, experience these states first of all and reflect upon them afterwards. How many of you have been to Paris? Yeah. Anyone? Only one. Maybe two or three have been to Paris. Those who haven't been to Paris, could you please reflect on Paris for me? What it's like? You can't reflect on Paris if you've never been there. So you go to Paris first of all, and then you start thinking and describing it. In the same way, for Dharma reflections, understand letting go. Go to the place where kindness leads you. Peacefulness. And at the end of the meditation, then you can reflect. Wow, what was that? Ah. Now I know what metta means. Now I know what a still mind is. The trouble is, people reflect too quickly before they're really clear what they're reflecting on. It's just empty thoughts, not grounded in reality. Have the reality first. Experience Paris. And then you can think about it. Not the other way around. How to handle the inner chattering. I've already said that, sharp. So that's actually by learning how to actually to value the stillness. See the spaces between the chatter. When it stops, before the next chattering
begins. Notice that, be mindful of that. You find that will come. And value the silence more than anything else. It's so beautiful. When you're silent, even when I gave that exercise of just noticing the space between my thoughts when I was actually making big spaces there, wasn't that nice? Wasn't that really beautiful? Wow, silence is so free. So when you value the silence, you really understand its importance, then it will grow. When you assume that thinking is more important, if you really understand that you're going to get wisdom through thinking, you're wasting your time. There are people who are much better thinkers than you are. People who practiced and practiced thinking so well that I can never think as good as they do. They're called philosophers. And do they actually understand the truth? Well, thinking never leads you to wisdom. Stillness does. So please value the silence. All the wisdom comes from silence, not from thinking. That wonderful space of emptiness. Where there's no words going on in the mind. And lastly, in the walking meditation, is it possible to do noting to keep aware of the walking process? Yeah, you can do noting if you like. So noting, lifting, moving, stepping down to your wrist. But after a while, stop the noting. Because the noting is just like a crutch which you first use to learn how to walk after an operation. After a while, you don't need to mention the word lifting, because you know what lifting is. You feel it rather than think it. There's too much noting and you become too much of a thinker. So that just means more and more thinking and stopping. So when you do a walking meditation, just see if you can just notice the feelings in the feet. If that doesn't work because, you know, it's the beginning of the retreat, you're not that still yet, there's another thing you can do with walking meditation which I recommend, especially today or tomorrow. You can use what we call a mantra when you're walking meditation. A mantra is like a set of words which you recite to yourself with the walking. And the mantra I encourage with walking meditation is as you move your left foot, you know inside your mind, I will die. As you move your right foot, that's for sure. I will die. That's for sure. I will die. That's for sure. Left foot, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. Try it. It's good fun. First, people who do this, they usually go through the same sequence of experiences. First of all, you think this is stupid. You think it's funny, it's a joke. But after a few minutes, you realize this is no joke. That's a truth which no one can deny. I will die. That's for sure. But when it's a truth, the next stage is you get scared. Quite easily, quite understandably, you get to fear. I will die, that's for sure. When you really keep pushing that, step after step after step, you get afraid. But carry on. I will die, that's for sure. And when you get to that fear, you get to understand it's absolutely true. I will die, that's for sure. You let go. You get very, very peaceful. But when you realize that I will die, that's for sure, all the stuff that you carry around with you is seen for what it is, not necessary at all. All the worries and attachments which you know will not be with you when you die, you have to let them go then. So when you do it, I'll know that for sure, you let go of them now. And you feel just so free. You let go. They're saying the words, you let go, baby. You let go. Carry on. Be free. I will die. That's for sure. For me. Try that with the walking meditation. Have a great time. But remember, you've got to persist. Go through the choking phase. Go through the, my goodness, this is true phase. goes through the fear stage, and then you get to the letting go. And that's a beautiful place to be. So try that today. I would like that to show. See what happens. Really good. Okay, any questions from the floor about what we've been saying today so far? Yeah, you got up there first and then I'll just. Yes.
I had some difficulties cuddling earlier yesterday afternoon because I was, I guess, smoking too much. And then I said, did a rest and do a bit of reading and remembered the story on just letting your mind go.
Yeah.
And I tried that and it really went.
Good.
But what I noticed after coming out of meditation was I went away quite quickly and I felt unconscious, as if I wasn't mindful at all. But I knew that my mind was running at supersonic speed, it was very, very fast. But just watching and then reflecting on it, I'm not sure whether I was mindful or is that just the way to go with how to think about mindful.
Okay, there's a lot you said there, but at the beginning of the retreat, you don't expect very much. So if you are tired, then go take a rest. Because sometimes, maybe you didn't sleep well last night, maybe go through some physical stuff. So if you really need to rest, rest. Now this is not a concentration camp. I'm not going to go to your room and haul you away from your bed and put you in the dungeon to watch everyone. So very, very kind. So if you really need to do that, do that. I love telling the story of, we can't go here because the accommodation doesn't really allow it. But there was this one lady at a retreat I gave in Sydney years ago. She was an executive. She came late because she had to finish off all the work really, really late at night in the office. And by the time she came to the retreat centre, most of us had already gone to bed. So she found her accommodation and slept. And she never came to the morning meeting. She got up for breakfast. And when she came for the first interview, I told her how to relax. She took my advice and practiced it. After the interview, she went straight back to bed. And she got up for lunch. And after lunch, she went back to bed again and had a rest. For the first 3 days, she would never get up for the morning sittings or chanting. After breakfast, she'd go to bed again and get up for lunch. Maybe a couple of hours in the afternoon, that's all. And other people thought that she was slacking off, thought that she wasn't really serious, and were actually, she told me, she said, I think the people in my dormitory are angry at me. And I told her, they're not angry at you, they're jealous. So which they had the guts to do that. So after 3 days, she had done mostly sleeping. But then she caught up. Her body was at ease then. The next 3 days, so that she caught up with everybody else. In the last 3 days, she was a star meditator. She went so deeper than most other people on that retreat. I used her as an example. Now, if you're really, really, really tired, take a break. Now, if your mind is getting stuffed up, too much thinking, go and take a cup of herbal tea or coffee, whatever you want, and have a walk around the grounds of the temple. Because if you don't do that, if you fight the mind, you're finding this works. You have to work with it with kindness. And now to hear gratitude. If you understand that, as many other stories, you understand how your mind thoughts your body needs, and of your mind needs, and your caring for your body, your mind. And then if you do that, you'll find that once your body is relaxed, your mind is relaxed. Meditation is just so easy. Just like that woman, she relaxed her body first of all, because it was just over-stress through her. And having dealt with her body, then her body and mind were just so free to get into some nice deep meditations. Even the Buddhist said, so be kind to her. And again, if your mind is going supersonic speed, you try and stop a supersonic jet. Can you stop it? There was a story from Thailand which we often use as a simile. A farmer was taking his water buffalo out to graze, and it was passing by our monastery when the water buffalo got scared and tried to run away. The stupid farmer tried to stop the water buffalo. Which is stronger, a farmer or a buffalo. Luckily, a buffalo is much stronger. That's why the buffalo pulls a plow, not the farmer. So he tried to stop the buffalo by holding onto the string tied around the buffalo's neck. The string wound around the man's finger. When the buffalo went off, so did half a finger. And that's why he came into our monastery with half a finger missing, the blood everywhere. It was very gross, but it's obviously not life-threatening. So just bandaged and cleaned the wound as best we could and took him to the hospital. And we use that story, that's a very stupid farmer. If he'd have let that buffalo go, it would not have ran far away. 200 meters, 500 meters at most. And then when he ran away, he'd calm down. Then the farmer needed only to walk slowly up the water buffalo and then pick up the string and lead the water buffalo back. You can't stop the water buffalo running away, otherwise it takes your fingers off it. And I think you all know what that simile means. Sometimes your mind is like a water buffalo running away, like your supersonic mind. If you try and stop that, it pulls off your fingers, you get damaged. So you let it run. Off you go, mind. It won't go that far. And when it comes down, then you gently bring it back. That's the way of wisdom. So thank you for that question. Now you had a question. Does that answer the question? Sort of? Yeah, let it be. You know you can't stop that. Let it be. And then when it gets calmed down, then you can put it back. Yes, you have a question?
Why does the mind refuse to let go? Is it because there's no sufficient wisdom and understanding?
Why does the mind resist letting go? It's because there's not enough wisdom, wisdom yet, skill yet. Yeah, that's very, very true. But it's also because sometimes we're afraid to let go. Because we're wondering, if I let go of control, my mind will go crazy. If I don't keep my mind in check, it will be impossible. But it's actually that when you let things go, the mind does become peaceful. Everything you've attained in your life so far, all the good things, you've worked for those. You strive and struggle at school, in your family life, in your work, at home, and you've achieved so much. And you think that now you can strive in the same way and get success in meditation. Meditation goes in the opposite direction. What works in your life doesn't work in meditation. Strive and struggle and work hard, you still don't get it. So don't try the strange strategies which work in your life. That's why many, many people don't get meditation. They've been achievers in life, and they try the same techniques in meditation in their care. In meditation, you have to go in the opposite direction, against the stream of praise and sentiment. You have to let go, and let things be. It's a strange thing, but for many people when they're meditating, one day, I just talked with someone earlier, well, they get so frustrated. They try, and nothing works. 6 days, 7 days, 8 days of meditation, people are getting nowhere. Oh, I just what the hell, I'm just up. And then they get peaceful. And at last they think, Dummy, why didn't I do that at the beginning? Why did I have to have so much frustration before I let go? So let go first. You can see inside of you there's this person you think of as yourself, this controller. You may not be able to give that thing a name, but it's a thing which made you ask the question. The one which is always in control of you, always telling you what to do, criticizing you when you get it wrong. That little thing inside of you, that's the problem. Give a shout that one. So what are you letting go of? It's this thing inside of you, always controlling and making things happen and judging and whatnot. And when you can see that once, and you can shut it up and just be. Not trying to go anywhere, not trying to get anything. Just being. Not judging, this is a good meditation or a bad meditation.
anything gets very peaceful and still. Ah, now I know what meditation is. And sometimes you have to meditate for years until you get it. You may go once and think, ah, that's so peaceful. Now this is how I meditate. I don't do it. I just get out of the way and it happens. So, just as a joke, I often tell people, Ajahn Brahm, I'm a meditation teacher. I've been a monk for so many years, but I confess to you in public, I can't meditate. I can't meditate. I have to disappear. And then meditation happens. What I see is the first thing I do is get rid of Ajahn Brahm. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. Get out of the way. When I get out of the way, then meditation happens. It gets so peaceful. When I try and do it, no way. So you have to disappear like Ajahn Brahm disappears. No self, no me, no I. Disappear. And then when you let go of this controller, things get so peaceful. But, ah, no, that's what I should be doing. Now that's the key. Everything else which you say is just fluff and it's just extras. The most important thing is you just disappear and get out of the way. Don't try. And just the more you start to strive, the bigger your ego. The more you let go, the more your ego disappears. Which is why it's a tough thing to do. We have to disappear. We're not comfortable with that. You always want to be in control. No, let go, disappear, it's fun. I guarantee it. So thank you for that question. And hopefully that every time a question like that comes up, you give an answer. Another piece of the jigsaw falls into place. So you've got a whole jigsaw puzzle that you know how to let go. Yeah?
Is acceptance same as love?
Acceptance, yeah. Acceptance is the same as love. It's the same as letting go. All these words are totally the same. Like dana, giving. What is giving? But giving up. Giving up control of some of your wealth by putting in donation box. What is loving kindness? Giving up of control. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. I'm not going to control you, I'm not going to judge you, I'm just going to love you for who you are. So you don't have to do anything to please me now. Isn't that beautiful? Yes, beautiful sense of freedom. No control. Letting go. Letting go, kindness, gentleness, peace. All the same. Somebody once told me that the word for love in German is Liebe. It comes from the same root as liberation. Liberation and liberality as well. Now, liberality is giving, being generous. Liberation is freedom. And Liebe, love. Love, freedom, giving. All comes from the same little word. And letting go. So if you have, you have to let go. Control. If you have a partner and you really love them, you should never control them. Darling, I love you for who you are. Kid, you're my son, my daughter. Yeah, I want you to do well in life and be happy, but even if you're not, you're my kid. As your mother, I always love you. Please remember that. That's unconditional love. So let it go. When you give love to your kid like that, they don't go crazy and go feral. They actually become really wonderful children. So when you let your mind be, she doesn't go all over the place. It stays still. My goodness, she loves me, says your mind. I'm going to stick around with her. If you hate your mind, it runs away. Do you like being with people who love you? So now you know how to stay with your mind. Love your mind. Don't try and control it. So if your mind is supersonic, don't be decided to mind if you're thinking supersonic. Oh, okay, mind. No, I can still love you, even though you're crazy about that. Then your mind will always come back to you. So thank you for those questions. And if you don't understand those answers,
I have put the seed inside your brain. It will work. I call this brainwashing. I have been conditioning you, brainwashing you, until that actually works. Just like I was brainwashed by Ajahn Chah, me by Ajahn Man, and it all goes back to the original brainwasher of the Buddha. And it works. It makes you peaceful. You have a wonderful time. So, see what happens. There's a couple of hours to go before lunch. And if, yeah?
I have a question.
Go on, okay.
In my younger days, I used to visit temples, and I came across someone who meditated halfway, sometimes there is. Being young, and it's terrifying to see that.
Yeah.
And now, my question is this. After seeing that, I never dared to try meditation because it's so terrifying to see this scenario. Now, as a meditator, do they actually know Satan has done? Second question, what caused it?
Yeah.
And third question, if we come through this stage, what can we do?
Okay. Usually the ones who get hysterical like that, it's out of frustration. They try so hard. But it doesn't work, they try harder. When that doesn't work, they try extremes to control. They don't know how to let go, they don't know how to be kind. So instead of using the Hanagiri strategy, they try to fight the mind, which is where they get the hysterical theory from. It's all coming from fighting. They lose the battle, which they must eventually do, because they're fighting things you cannot control. So I remember this guy I knew, when I was, it's an interesting story because I saw this fellow last year. I went up to London last year, and I met up with some old college friends I hadn't seen for 40 years. And this guy was something, the most senior actuary in the whole of Europe. So he's top of his profession, earns a fortune. For this particular occasion, that he was experimenting with LSD in college. And I saw him in Magdalen Bridge. Oh, not Magdalen Bridge, it's another bridge. Get what it was anyway. But anyway, yeah, I met him there, and he was high on LSD. He said, "I'm going crazy, I'm mad, I have to go to hospital." And I was wise enough then to say, "That's all right, be mad. I didn't want to be mad, be mad." And he actually got it and said, "Oh, that makes sense. Okay, I'll just be mad." And when he stopped fighting it, he was sane. And he came down, there's no problem at all. Because that makes that fear of losing control, which would have taken him into madness. It's that fear of losing control which makes you hysterical. Let go, lose control. Meditation, for some people, can be very sensitive. And that's why the way of letting go and of kindness is the safest, most wonderful way of meditating. Use force, struggle and strive, and that can be dangerous. For most people, no problem at all. But for some very sensitive people, it can be dangerous. For a long time, I thought that people who are schizophrenic would not be able to meditate. Because people with schizophrenia, sometimes the things which they imagine inside their mind are more real than the things which they can see and touch. And they take their illusions to be reality, and reality to be an illusion. And that means they can hear sounds, they can... You know, this white guy said he saw like human hairs just rolling across the floor, and he thought that was real. When reason would say that must be just imagination, no one else can see that. But I have one monk in my monastery who is clinical schizophrenic, and he's dealing with his disease so wonderfully well that the doctors over in Perth are doing case studies about it. How on earth can we deal with this in such a wise and effective way? By letting go and being kind, being gentle, controlling things. He's a wonderful monk. He's very young, but I just wait for him to have some few more years to let go of teaching. He'd be a very, very powerful teacher. Because he's had a very difficult disease to deal with. And he's dealt with it in a Buddhist way, which is so impressive. He's no problem at all. He's a great man.
somebody at peace with himself and his life, happy, very lovely person to be around, incredibly wise. So that's actually what happens. If you struggle and strive and get the wrong instructions, then it does sometimes send you over the edge. Some people, not most. This way, another way is it creating problems. I've had no casual teaching yet. I've been teaching a long time. And I don't intend to ruin my 100% reputation on this retreat in Washington. So you're perfectly safe. Yes?
Let's say when we let go and we start thinking in pictures, something like think of a bubble moving from big to small and correspond with breathing in and breathing out.
Right. That's the way it all works, okay? So whatever happens, oh, this is fun, this is interesting, just enjoy it.
We are not supposed to enjoy it.
Ah, well, that's a great question. Who said that? My goodness, enjoy your meditation. If you don't enjoy it, what the heck are you doing here? This is not a torture camp. You think you're giving up 8-9 days of your life to suffer? Well, that is enough suffering. This is Club Med, you know, this is enjoyable. So thank you for that question. You haven't mentioned this. Some people mistakenly understand if you enjoy meditation, it must be bad because you can get attached. And that's bad, bad, bad. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at any of the original teachings of the Buddha, you find the stages there, Anapanasati Sutta, breathing in, breathing out, you generate happiness. Breathing in and out, you generate joy. You're supposed to enjoy this. It's part of the meditation. And in the Pasadika Sutta of the Giga Nikaya, I'm quoting this so you can check me out. I don't make this up. This is the word of the Buddha. He said, anyone who indulges basically gets attached to the happinesses of the mind, especially the happiness of the jhana. You can only expect one of four consequences. This is what happens if you do indulge in the happiness of deep meditation. Only one of all consequences. Stream meaning, number one. Once returning, number two. Number three, long returning. And number four, arahant. That's what the Buddha said will happen to you if you're attached to the pleasures of the mind. You up for that? You want to become stream meaning or an arahant? And attached to the pleasures of the mind. Said the Buddha. He said there are two types of, this is Arana Vimanga Sutta. He said you should distinguish between the two types of pleasure. The pleasures of the five senses, which you should avoid, they're dangerous and they don't mean anything. And the pleasures of the mind, which you should follow, make much of, develop, and cultivate. Asle Vittabhang, Bahunikatabhang, Bahunikatabhang, Na Bayitabhang. You should follow, cultivate, develop, and not interfere with those measures. Said the Buddha. I'm mentioning Pali. Just to impress you. Don't be afraid of those measures. So when you start to get fun, well done, you're getting somewhere. That's a sign of focus. Don't be afraid of that fun. Because that fun and joy will get so strong that will take you into the deep meditation. And those deep meditations will give you enlightenment. Joy of the mind is part of the path. You cannot get into enlightenment without following that joyful path. So when it starts to get fun, don't throw it away. It's meant to happen. Go for it. And don't be afraid. Even the Buddha, this is in the Mahasatika Sutta, number 36 of the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha was recounting the story of his enlightenment, when after trying all sorts of ascetic practices for 6 years and getting absolutely nowhere, because it's all control freak type practice, asceticism, then he remembered the time under the Bodhisattva tree when he was only a young boy and he got the first dana. And then he thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure? I will not be afraid of that pleasure, because that may be the way to enlightenment. And the insight came that is the way to enlightenment. It was because they were pleasurable. He too thought that can't be any part of ending suffering. He realized it is. He taught that path afterwards. So if you get to be fun,
well done. If
you're getting something, carry on. Don't run away.
Yes.
Someone told me, don't get caught in someone's stage or get addicted, but must move into vipassana. How true is this comment?
It is not true at all. How did the Buddha become enlightened? He went to jhanas first of all. Stillness, deep stillness of the mind. And as a result of that, he had got insight. In Pali, Samadhi Pachaya Yata Bhutayana Dasana. From Samadhi, from deep stillness, as a cause, you see things as they truly are. In other words, you have to be very, very still to see the Dhamma.
That means Samantha Vipassana, it does not matter,
you
just let it come naturally.
Well done. Just let it come naturally. Because it does, it's a natural path. Whether you like it or not, you get still, you'll see the Dhamma. Nothing to do with you controlling. Let it go and it happens. Make it happen, you get confused. Yes.
From reading the Dharma books, they say there's a vitakka and vichara.
Yes.
Something of the character thought and something thought. But is this thought different from the thinking that is
in the Yes, it is. The vitakka vichara, this is Pali words which mean different things in different contexts. Normally it does mean a plural thought and they're pondering. But in the jhanas, it doesn't mean that at all. Thoughts has long since disappeared by the time you get into deep meditation. Thinking, you know, is disturbing, it's not stillness. So what it actually means in the deep meditation is the subtle local movement of the mind onto the object. It's not to thinking at all, totally automatic, without any verbalization, no names, no words.
Not at the beginning stage, not for beginners.
Now, at the beginner stage, it is thinking. But at the jhana stage, it is just a movement of the mind with no verbalization going on. But as one of my friends noticed that he was comparing the Pali suttas with the Chinese arguments. Because all of these great teachings of the Buddha have been recorded in two versions. There's the Pali suttas, the Theravada, but the Chinese many, many centuries ago, millennia ago, translated from Pali to Chinese, and it's very easy to translate back again. And one of the people noted that the words, the Chinese characters they used for vitakka vichara were different for ordinary vitakka vichara and vitakka vichara in the context of jhanas. So they realized that jhanas is not thinking as we know. It's a completely different concept. They just have to use the same word in Pali, but different words in Chinese. Absolutely. Yes, in back.
After that meditation helps clear the mind and probably like in others. And how about animals who actually have more instinct than humans? Is that because they have more time to do meditation? How do you learn from them?
Okay, so the meditation becoming still, having a very peaceful mind, and animals no meditation because they're instinctual. Now I think that what happens in meditation, you get very, very peaceful, very still, but still very mindful, very alert. I'm not sure how many animals are that mindful. And certainly they can't sit still for very long without falling asleep. I notice all the dogs around here are fast asleep most of the day. They seem to get up at night and bark and disturb us all. But anyway, it's very hard actually to see an animal with such wisdom. Instinctual, yes, but mostly run by fear. Fear of predators, fear of competitors, fear of being beaten up. And that's a very terrible thing to watch. So, as a human being, we have safety and freedom from fear.
which is something which most animals don't have. So far, that's why you must always have lots and lots of love and kindness towards animals. They're so much more powerful than they are. We can crush them and hurt them so easily. So in our presence, they have a natural fear, as you might have if you were faced with a tiger. She could eat you. So be kind so the animals don't have any fear. But instinctual, instinctual self-preservation, fear, is not real wisdom. I don't know what you can learn from animals. No animals, one of the nice things is they don't worry. So I've never seen a dog or a cat worried about where the next meal's coming from. And they let go very quickly. You know, the dog, you know, you can sort of hit it, the next minute it's licking you. So the dogs are very, very loyal and very faithful and very loving and protective. That's why many, many people, they'd rather have a dog than a husband. It's true these days that they said, if I want a partner, right? I want someone who, when I come home, they sniff me, and when I've got strange smells, they love it. But, you know, when I come home and my wife's listening, I've got some strange smells, they want to do the mistresses. We've always just had this theory, there were some complaints. All they really want is a pattern and a bowl of food. Anyway. Sort of, I don't think we animals are really into meditation. Do you know any animals who meditate? I know an interesting story which is it's important, well, it's relevant to the discussion we've had so far, and that is the story of the bird. Because a bird sleeps at night in the trees. And have you ever wondered why it is that when it's a windy night, even a storm, the birds don't fall out from the trees? Sometimes I wonder, when those trees are swaying so wildly, those birds can't get a moment of sleep at night because they have to hang on for dear life. And that's actually not how it works. Because the way a bird's claws are designed, the more they relax, the more the claws close. If they really truly relax and fall asleep, those claws are so tight they cannot fall off the tree. But when it gets tense, when it tries to do something, the claws open up and then it falls off. The more it relaxes, the more stable it is. Just like meditation. The more you let go, the more you stay on the object of meditation. The more you try, the more you fall off the tree. That's the nature of a bird. The more it relaxes, the more the claws close, and it's stable. The more it tries, the more it opens up and falls off. Just like in meditation. The more you try to meditate, the harder it becomes. The more you relax and let go, the easier it is. You don't fall off from meditation or feel calm. Yes, last question now as we do some meditation. He got there first. Maybe two more, and then we'll finish off.
And recently you told that the more you put like letter, but in Satipatthana Sutta there is a saying, Atapi Sampajana Satipa. That means with ardent effort and there is a clear comprehension.
There's
continuous mindfulness.
Are
we have to strive or something like that?
Ah, no, atapi. The effort is the effort to let go. It is the effort to actually relax. It's the effort to stop, to say no, to renounce. Not the effort to do. So it is an effort, a striving. But it's a striving to stop striving. Effort to relax, which we have to do because our nature is always to do things and to struggle. It's called by the word in Pali is virya. Virya is energy or effort. But I noticed learning Pali that is connected to the word vira, which is the word for hero. So But virya is not just ordinary effort, it's heroic effort, like a soldier goes into battle and willing to let go of his life for the king. That's the hero. So virya is a willing to let go of yourself. And that's the willingness to abandon, to let go, to renounce for the higher cause. That's the type of energy which is necessary for meditation. There's no energy. The other type of energy, where's that coming from? That's coming from you, your ego, your sense of self. And that just builds up a stronger sense of self. You won't be able to transcend the sense of atta if you put forth on an ego like that. Letting go, the sense of self gets weaker and weaker. Until in deep meditation, the state of letting go, the sense of self vanishes. You're not doing anything at all. Last question, and then we actually do some meditation. Yes.
Another question on control and letting go as well. How does one watch the breath and yet not control it? Because I realize that the moment I'm aware of my breath, I can't discern whether am I breathing because I'm conscious or am I just breathing naturally.
Okay, you know you're controlling it when the breath is unnatural, when it's not peaceful, it's not happy. Because sometimes you interrupt yourself. You've been listening to me talking for almost 2 hours now. Now, your breath right now is natural. Goes in and out without any problem at all. As soon as you start to watch it, it becomes unnatural. In the same way, I now want you to become aware of the saliva in your throat. Can you become mindful of the saliva in your throat? Now it's unnatural. You have to swallow or you don't resist swallowing. It's totally unnatural once you start observing it. That's our problem. Once we watch something, we interfere with it. So when you first watch the breath, it will become unnatural. You can't resist that. So then you relax. So that after a few minutes, you're watching the natural breath and not interfere with it anymore. Like it's sitting on the side of the lake, watching the water rather than in the lake watching the water. You just detach. You let things be. You know you relax and the breath is just going in exactly the same way as if you were watching it at all. That's what happens. Very good question. Is that okay?